epiroic. They had fled for different climes.
The poor bastards are terrified, said Augustine.
There was nothing to see in the river yet. No brain, no hint of beast, no far-off haze that indicated anything amiss. When you came around, you found you were the only one sitting in a circle of standing lictors, their faces like blank flimsy, their rapiers in their hands, their off-hands at the ready. The saint of duty with his spear, the saint of patience with his small sword, the saint of joy with her net, Ianthe with her trifold knife. You stared numbly at these faces, wondering which one would betray God at the last. At the beginning of that last week, you still believed you might live, despite the briefing's assumption that you would not. In the middle of that last week, the Emperor of the Nine Houses, the Necrolord Prime, invited you to his rooms after supper to talk. When you sat in that now familiar armchair before that now familiar coffee table, the great window now a flat darkness, the ship a belly you were all nestling within, he surprised you by only offering you water and a very plain cracker. You found yourself able to nibble its edges and tasted only flour and salt.
I know you said no the last time, said Teacher. I respected it. I won't offer again, except to say, if at any point before the final shutters come down, if at any point before Mercy Morn locks me in, you come to me and ask to get locked in with me, it will be done. You have 10,000 years before you, Harrow Hark.
You did not address this. Instead, you said, Lord?
Teacher.
You said, You are the Prince Undying. You are the Necrolord Highest. Why do we lock you inside an airless room?
He rested back in his chair and locked his fingers together over his belly.
You've hit upon a sore spot, Harrow Hark, he said affably, brown brows crinkling together. I am your salvation and your light. Who should I fear?
I never meant to, you said, leaning forward. I just want to understand. Please?
What happens to your body when you go under, Harrow? When you go into the river?
You had long passed the point where you needed to think about it. The body enters a senseless state. The lictor doesn't perceive anything around them in any sense. Even their necromancy fails. Instead, the secondary soul comes to the fore, the protection mechanism that can wield a sword even if their mind is gone, without conscious thought or awareness of its own, but with a perfect sword hand, if they were functional.
The Emperor of the Nine Houses drummed his fingers over his belt. It still hurt you a little to look into his terrible eyes, the irises like black shadows of the Canaanite white, that iridescent absence of colour, a shade rather than a tint, the purity of the white ring, then the matte black of the sclera. You had never become used to it.
A myriad ago, I resurrected 9 planets, he said, and I reignited the central star, and I called it Dominicus. As a reminder, Dominus Illuminatio Mea et Salus Mea Quem Timebo. God is my light. Harrow Hark, if I went under, I'd enter that senseless state. And I am God. What if, 40 billion light-years away, my people looked up to see Dominicus falter and go out? What if the very house beneath their feet died all over again as I turned my back upon it?
You said, So if you die, the houses die with you. The star warming our system fails and becomes a gravitational well, as I understand it.
Yes, a black hole like the one that took out Cyrus, he said. I can only hope you'd all be dead already. Oh, there'd still be cohort ships, hold planets, a scattering of us. But we would be so few, and so many people hate us, and my work is not yet done. I cannot behold that apocalypse, Harrow. I think you are one of the only lictors who can really and truly understand apocalypse. It is not a death of fire. It's not showy. You and I would almost prefer the end if it came as a supernova. It is the inexorable setting of the sun without another hope of morning. Both of you fell into silence. If I fought the resurrection beast, I'd leave my houses to die, he said. If I fought the heralds, I might well go mad, which would be the same thing. So I'm shut in here, walled in, really, to prevent the nine houses becoming nun houses with left grief.
He looked very tired. He looked very rueful. He said,
Once again, you're not the only one with limitations. May I ask you a question, teacher? You're not sick of them yet? You said, Who was A.L.?
His eyes flew open. God sat up straight in his chair, looked at you in open astonishment, and he said,
Are you sure you want to go with that one? Let's go through all the other, less awkward ones first. How is a baby made? I can do that, easy. I mean, I don't want to, but I'm ready. I have this little book about babies, bodies, friends and family. Are you and Ianthe being safe?
It was your turn to sit up straight in your chair and in tone, constructing each syllable with the same rigid emphasis you might give to a skeleton.
We are not intimate. Sorry. I mean, you're about the same age. I don't really know how this goes anymore. We've all been alive for too long. Neither are we romantic. Neither are we, frankly, platonic. Sorry, 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 he added. I should not assume these things.
If your paint could have baked upon your face and crumbled off like clay, it would have. If you could have willed the saint of duty to burst through the door, skewer you through, and parade your gored body around the room, you would have. You began to get up.
If I have overstepped, teacher, forgive me. I withdraw the question. No, he said. Let's talk about her. Let's talk about my bodyguard.
Carefully, you sat back down. God said,
You've been listening to Augustine and Mercy Morn.
Yes.
It wouldn't be Autus. Poor Augustine. Poor Mercy. They still feel badly. They still carry their apportioned blame. I think, yes, that it's time for you to know about A.L.
He pronounced her name, as both his wayward saints had, as two clearly separate letters. You could hear the A and the L. He said,
It stood for a couple of things. A joke, mostly. I often called her Annabel Lee, Annie Laurie. When I first met her, I just called her First. One. She had a real name, but I buried it with her, and nobody says it any more. She has been dead for nearly 10,000 years, but she keeps her vigil with me as a memory, if nothing else. Annabel Lee was my... What do I call her? Guide? Friend? I'd hoped so.
You did not know how to respond to this. He did not seem to need a response. God said,
She was the first resurrection. She was my Adam. As the dust settled and I beheld what was left and what was gone, I was entirely alone. The world had been ended, Harrow Hark. One moment I was a man, and then the next moment I was the Necrolord Prime, the first necromancer, and more importantly, a landlord with no tenants.
You said, Teacher, what destroyed the house of the first?
Not much, said the Emperor, and he tried to smile. It was awful. Rising sea levels in a massive nuclear fission chain reaction. It all went downhill from there.
This quiet admission provided the first details you had ever heard of the pre-resurrection extinction. As mythologies went, it felt distant and unreal. He continued. It wasn't gorgeous dust to be left in, Harrow. I was dazed. I was bewildered. And she was my defender and my sole companion, and my colleague in the scholarship of learning how to live again. It was bloody difficult. I had never been God. He trailed off here. Then he said, she lived to see what happened at Canaan House. Not that she took much interest. My first resurrection was not a normal human being, Harrow, and she struggled to pretend. Anger was her besetting sin. We had that in common. And when the cost of lictorhood was paid, when the emotions were at their peak, we found out the price for our sin. The monstrous retribution. To be chased for our crime to the ends of the universe, to have our deeds stain our very faces and follow after us like a foul smell. She died after that first terrible assault. You did not say, I am sorry. You did not offer empathy. As with many mysteries, this one had turned out to be sad and dull. The Emperor of the Nine Houses had someone, and then, like all his victors, the Emperor of the Nine Houses had lost someone. It was your story. It was Xianthe's story. It was the story of Augustine and of Mercy Morn, and of Ortus. It was Kithareo's story, and that of all the lictors who had died over that long, dark sheaf of years. I understand why Cavaliers Primary carry their house titles, said God. It makes sense, but it is a corruption of the original. Do you know why you're really the first? Because, in a very real way, you and the others are A.L.'s children. There would be none of you, if not for her. And then the Emperor of the Nine Houses set down his empty mug of tea with the residue of ginger biscuit crumbs within. You had no idea, in those seconds after the gentle clink upon the table surface as the universe held its breath, that he was about to say the worst thing that had ever been said to you. The fine, forbearing lines at his forehead and at his eyes crinkled earnestly, and he said, I like to think that she would like you. You'd make a hell of a daughter, Harrow Hark. I sometimes indulge in the wish that you'd been mine. There had been a moment in your life when you were convinced that you were about to spoil your substance at the foot of Ianthe Tridentarius's altar. You had been granted reprieve. There was no such reprieve for you in that moment. You had not sold the marrow of your soul for stolen eyes and a half-hearted kindness. What dismantled you, you bereft idiot, was not even the god who made the ninth house, the emperor all-giving, the kindly prince. Your end appeared in the form of a grown adult telling you that they might have liked you for their own. You hurled the glass to the table. It shattered into a flower of water with a crackling multitude of shards for sepals. You stood upon that table. It creaked beneath your weight. God had half stood to stop you when you sank to your knees on the glass. You kneeled into obeisance on the razor-sharp fragments, pressed your palms down into the shrapnel, and you folded yourself into wet and bleeding penitence before him. He said, Harrow, no! He was distraught. He said, Please, Harrow Hark, I'm sorry. I have obviously said something immensely stupid. I do that, eh? I never wanted to hurt you. He said, 10,000 years, and I am still such a fool. You might have told him of the traitor. Instead you said, I broke into the locked tomb. After a moment, God said, You did not. The wards to the stone were easily bypassed, you said. The line of reverend mothers and reverend fathers has been responsible for their upkeep for years. The barriers and gates beyond were more difficult. I was 9 years old when I began, and 10 by the time I could traverse the shaft.
I spent a whole year working on nothing but those locks. When I came to the blood ward on the stone, the ward of the tomb keeper, I did not know how to pass. It remains the most complex piece of magic I have ever seen. It was my first vision of the necromancer divine, but one day, when I was 10 years old, I decided to end my own life, Lord, and sometimes I think it was that which let me cross the tomb keeper's gate. I opened it. I saw the saline water that laps the stony shore, and I walked into the sepulchre. I have seen the tomb, and I have looked upon your death. My parents killed themselves over my heresy. I saw what lies within, and I will love it beyond my own entombing. Did I sin, Lord? Did I kill two of my fathers that day? You were panting tiny, sharp puffs of breath from the back of your throat. You knelt on the broken glass on the flat table before him, damp with blood and water. You did not weep, but only because you no longer knew how. The Emperor of the Nine Houses could only have been quiet for 5 seconds. To you, it felt like 100,000 years. And then he said, very gently, no, you didn't. You pressed your face into the surface of the table, and you closed your eyes so violently that the pressure stung your brows and cheeks. No star hung so still as you did then, at the end of its hard hydrogen burn, breathlessly waiting to slough off its outer layer. And he said, Harrow, whatever you thought you did, you didn't.
I opened the outer door.
Okay, he said. I went up the passage. I'll accept it, though that thing's a literal death trap, he said.
I broke the ward, and I rolled away the rock.
That's where you're wrong, he said.
You did not lift your head, but said, I was 10 years old, but I was not a child. I set myself one task. I studied for one purpose. Don't consider my limitations, God. I am not a person. I am a chimera.
We won't get into that. But don't think I am discounting the genius of a single-minded, necromantically augmented 10-year-old, he said. I'm not saying that you didn't do it because you weren't good enough. Harrowhark, I'm saying that nobody is good enough. There isn't a bypass. I built that tomb with Anastasia, designed every inch of it, and I did not include a way in. I never wanted that tomb opened from either end. I made that ward, me, alone, and it wouldn't answer to the greatest of my lictors any better than the meanest infant necromancer in all the Nine Houses. Their might would be one and the same.
The supernova of your heart went out, faded, as swiftly as it had shone. It became thick and miniature and dense. You lifted your head minutely, and an embedded fragment of glass fell from your temple, from a string of red blood.
It can't be broken, he continued. It can't be contravened. It can't even fade. Its magic was my magic. The line of reverend tomb-keepers has laboured under a misapprehension if they think the rock could be rolled away except by me. It's a pure blood ward, Harrowhark. Whatever you thought you did, whatever false chamber has been built around that tomb that you mistakenly stumbled into, there is no possibility that you breached the real thing. I am so sorry. You were party to a tragedy based on a misunderstanding.
You were rendered down to your incoherent parts. You wanted to say, I saw the body. You wanted to say, I saw the tomb. But you were seized all over again by doubt in the face of fact. The uncertainty of the insane. The conviction of the mad. Nobody had seen you walk through that door. Nobody had watched you leave. What he saw in your face, you had no idea, only that he crouched, And he looked at your blind, bleeding numbness with those phonic eyes, and he wiped his thumb over the part of your temple where the glass shard had buried itself, and he tucked a stray lock of hair behind your ear with the thoughtless, gentle tidiness of a parent. Then God's eyes widened fractionally, and his voice became altogether different when he said, "Harrow, who the hell's been tampering with your temporal lobe?" Your body rolled itself off the table with such a reflexive suddenness that you were not sure that the action was through your conscious effort. Your meat floundered to stand, wild with shards of lead crystal and a dozen cuts through your clothes, and you turned away. The Emperor said, "Harrow Hark," as you stumbled away from the table, and more plaintively, "Harrow Hark," as you unerringly careened to the door. But he did not follow. Somehow your hand slapped the pad that slid it open. Somehow your meat dragged itself away from him. And you walked, and you walked, and you walked. As the door closed, you might have heard, "Damn it, John! Damn it!" But the last thing you were going to do was trust your own ears. Chapter 38. You only started to accept your death after that terrible evening. It was impossible to ignore the manifold symbols of desolation. For example, the body had made good on her word and disappeared. She had been your quiet companion since your lictorhood. She had faithfully kept tryst with you, and in the morning, after the sleep you could not remember and the walk back to your room you could not recall, it struck you that she was not coming back. Nobody would come for you. The path was cleared for you to die, and the lovely woman lying chained to the marble had not been able to bear to watch your progress on it. Or perhaps it was just that she had never existed, except within a 10-year-old's fever dream. The hours stretched themselves out to snapping point. You ate with a mechanical stolidity, even if you would rather not have. You washed yourself, and you dressed yourself, without a flicker of interest. Now, when you caught sight of yourself in the mirror, it was with a certain repelled bewilderment, as if you had never seen your face before, and it honestly seemed as though you had not. On one of the last days, you discovered with distant consternation that you were trying to leave your rooms without even applying your paint. You thought of trying to write a letter. To whom? Crux? Captain Iglamine? Your wretched great-aunts? To God? To Ianthe? Should you plan your funeral, aiming to beat the Saint of Joy's frugal 24 minutes? Once you would have asked your corpse to be sent back to your house, to be walled up in the Anastasian, the last daughter in the tomb-keeper line. But perhaps even your empty vessel would attract a planetary revenant. No, your body could never go back home. You decided to write, "Toss me out of the airlock." But thankfully, this puerile self-pity sobered you up a little, and you did not bother to begin. The only real advantage to those last few days was that of the swordsman with the 1,000 scars. One more could not harm you. There was very little left to surprise, and very little left to sicken. But on the penultimate night before the resurrection beast was due, you dropped your glove down the side of the bed. You had to kneel down to retrieve it, and you found that far beneath your bed, hidden in the darkness where you had once lain, waiting for the saint of duty, lay an inert corpse. The missing body of Kitherea. You lay in that gap between the frame and the floor on the outside of the bed for quite a long time. You had not sensed any foreign thanagy in your room, nor trace of hostile serum. Even now she lay docile and dusty, empty in your sight. You extended your fingers to brush her arm, and there was the ever-present sign of God keeping her preserved, with the hot lemon scour of his divine necromancy punching the back of each sinus. She lay still as an abandoned doll. You even said,
Get up. I can see you. But this command did not rouse her for some reason. At the time, you did not wonder how the body had breached your wards, which you dutifully reapplied each night with fresh blood. You considered the corpse. You bracketed thick bone clamps to its dead ankles and dead wrists, and then you strode down the corridor, and when Ianthe answered your crabby knocking with a sleepy, "Nona Jezimus, what do you..." You did not give her time to finish her sentence, but dragged her by the icy gold of her skeleton arm back to your bedroom. She did not protest, or make a comment, coarse or otherwise. She was too surprised. Ianthe raised her eyebrows at you as you pointed her to beneath your bed, but she took her nightgown in her fists and crouched down to look between the mattress and the floor. And she said, after a long moment, "What am I looking at?" You experienced a hot moment of aggravated panic, but when you crouched down with her, the lictor's corpse was still there, dead and unmoving in her bracelets of bone. You said, "It's right there." She did not answer. You said, "The body, Tridentarius. Kithareia's body. Kithareia's body is beneath my bed." She did not answer. You rattled, mindless. "On its back, arms at the sides, feet arranged at a 30-degree angle." Ianthe sat up and brushed down her knees. She looked at you with an expression you could not pass in the diminished light, only it had been made with great care. She said, "I can't see anything, Harrowhawk." You stared at her. The Princess of Ida looked down, then away, and then slid her gaze deliberately back to you, as though it were difficult. You realized she was embarrassed. "Have you been sleeping?" she asked tactfully. "It's no more than 3 feet away from us, Tridentarius." "I wouldn't blame you if the answer is no. My beauty sleep is seriously impaired at the moment." "Touch it! Get under there!" She did not move. You said, "Touch it!" Ianthe rose soundlessly to her feet, and the long skirts of her nightgown, a brilliant ruffled canary yellow silk that made her look like a formal lemon, rustled restively around her calves. She said, "I'm going back to bed." Despite the layers of deadened scar tissue, there was still enough limberness in your soul for you to say, "Ianthe, for God's sake, have mercy!" She paused at your threshold. The violent yellow made her hair look white and gave her skin no colour found in skin. She said, light and careless, "Good night, Harrowhawk," and she walked out of your rooms. You looked at your door. You looked beneath your bed. You went to your sink, and you ran the tap until you could splash the coldest water possible on your face. You took 5 deep breaths in and 5 deep breaths out. You closed your eyelids and rolled your eyes in your sockets. Then you went and looked beneath your bed again. Kithareia was gone. There were cuffs of bone glued to the floorboards. You had left it for maybe 3 minutes. No ward braid. You searched the rest of the room, but there was no corpse to be found. You lay down on the bed, and if you'd had the ability, you might have cried bitterly from sheer desire to feel release, but you could not, and no release came. On the last day, for the last time, the Saint of Duty tried to kill you. You were coming out of the habitation atrium. You had stood briefly at the entrance to the tomb where Kithareia's body no longer lay at rest, perhaps in the hope that she might coalesce before your eyes and rewrite reality. And when this inevitably failed to happen, you had walked away, hoping to find the remains of somebody's leftovers to listlessly gnaw upon in the kitchen. Ortis hit you out of nowhere like the hammer of God. He tackled you just as you stepped into the corridor,
body slammed you into the wall with an almighty crunch, prematurely ending the long afterlife of an engraved skeleton inlaid with black pearl that had been fixed to the wall holding a big waterfall sheaf of ebon grasses. You automatically fixed the small cracked oblongs of your nasal bones into position as you flung him away again, reawakening the broken memorial into an array of shoving palms pistoning forward from one almighty synovial joint. He slammed into the opposite wall, and you backed away down the corridor, bleeding a little, measuring the distance between you and his spear. He barked,
"Draw your sword!"
Immediately, you reached for the bone-scabbarded blade you kept lashed to your back, he said with a touch of frustration.
"Your rapier!"
And you just stared. He held his spear in his left hand, its point a razor-sharp omen, and his plain rapier with the scarlet ribbon in his right. An ancient funeral bouquet was in tatters by his feet. Ortus had not shaved his head in the last week or so, and the stubble on his bony skull was a cap of brownish russet fuzz like a splash of forgotten blood. "There's no reason to kill me," you said, and marvelled at it suddenly, the ease of the conclusion. The saint of duty did not answer you. He stood in the corridor with an impassive face, and you said, "The resurrection beast will be here within hours. I am going to die, and yet you are here to kill me now?" He did not answer. "That isn't the act of someone removing a liability. You are either killing me for fun, doubtful, or out of anger, I'm unsure why, or for personal gain." Ortus looked at you again. Then he sheathed that plain rapier and twitched the wicked point of his spear up to face the ceiling.
"You're wrong," he said.
"How?"
"You're still a liability."
"Tell me!" You thought he would not answer. But then he said, haltingly, in the manner of a man saying something difficult in a language he did not speak well,
"Don't go to the river. End it yourself. Before they breach, cut off your oxygen, or however you like."
"At your expression," Ortus added as though it were an explanation.
"So you don't suffer."
"Why do you care if I suffer?"
"Because I was the one who failed you," he said briefly. "I pulled too many punches."
"And?"
"Sorry."
"And, most horribly of all,
this wasn't my idea."
Then the saint of duty turned and walked away from you, disappearing out the mouth of the corridor into the habitation atrium and beyond. You were suddenly seized with the conviction that the universe would not have judged you if you had lain down in that corridor, shed 15 years, and thrown an absolute tantrum. If you had pelted the cool panel floor beneath you with hands and fists and wailed. It meant so much that you would die with so many questions unanswered, would go to your unkind grave understanding absolutely jack shit. "Whose idea?" you called after him, and your voice rose to a shriek. "Whose idea?" In a way, it helped. Nothing added to your resolution to live so much as someone else suggesting that you die. 10 minutes later, you were eating leftover stew in the kitchen with something close to animation, choking down your last lunch before the apocalypse, and you were angry. You were always such a little bitch when you were angry. Chapter 39. The Heralds of Number 7, the ghost of a swiftly murdered planet in the domain of Dominicus, arrived that evening, around 43 minutes before the habitation lights were due to go off. They had already been dimmed to preserve power, as apparently the defense mechanism locked inside a lictor did not need light to fight by, nor senses of any kind, in fact. Mercy Morn said they did not even feel pain. Unlike them, you generally needed light and felt pain. But you were the reverend daughter of the ninth house. The first was negotiable, and the second was irrelevant. When the first herald broke through the Mithraeum's honour guard of asteroids, it was not particularly terrifying. You had made your preparations. You sat on the floor before your window that looked out onto nothing. The great sword you had taken off and laid before you, as though it were a beloved talisman and not a sickening, befuddling relic, a back-breaking burden your dead self told you to carry. You were almost fond of it, except when you looked at it, at which point all fondness was dispelled. The courier of the beast landed on a part of the Mithraeum's hull very far away from you. You did not feel the impact or hear a sound. It was only when Augustine's voice came over the communicator, "Confirmed impact, West Quadrant, Third Ring, Engineering Room," that you even knew it existed. God's voice. "How many minutes before you're in the halo?" "Depends. Impact again. Also west. Third ring, same location. Are they spearheading? Impact! North quadrant, habitation ring. Ortus, that's quite near you." A crackle.
"I'm fine."
Another crackle. Mercy's voice.
"Less chatter on the line. Wait until they breach. They'll try to smother us first and roast the station."
"No temperature change," said God.
Then you felt it. The first vibrational thump, and it sounded astonishingly close. From above you, direction was difficult, thanagetic sense irrelevant. What sounded like a small meteor had struck the hull of the Mithraeum. Silence before, and silence after. There was no distant roaring perceived through the shudder of the hull and shutters, no monstrous noise, no pageantry. The messengers of the resurrection beast arrived without fanfare, and for a moment you resented the anticlimax. Augustine, on the comm.
"Confirmed. East quadrant, habitation. That's you girls. Don't bite your tongues."
You thought it was one of Augustine's little jokes, until the fear hit you. It hit as a smell. Your nostrils quivered, and your head was filled with a strange petroleum odour, redolent of old machines. But there was a sweetish underlayer to it, like vomit. It assaulted you in the manner of a migraine headache. Then the punch, like the saint of joy to one's kidneys, low in your stomach, racing up the central line of your body, seizing your heart in its teeth and shaking. Your palms ran wet. You made a gulping, galloping sound in the back of your throat. You tried to close your eyes as though that was some escape, but it was not. You tilted forward, gasping, your pulse bellowing, your ears deafened. You were suddenly convinced that there were little things crawling over your skin. You rubbed frantically at your forearms. You shivered convulsively, as though to fling them off. You touched obsessively at your ears. You cringed when a stray hair fell across your forehead. But as you lurched, fretted, perceived, you fought. You made yourself one inhalation and exhalation, reduced yourself to one sensation, following it from down at the toes, up all the lines of your body to the crown of your head. As the sensation rose, you filled with contempt for a stranger's insanity. You had enough of your own to contend with. After a few minutes, you came to with nothing more than a sense of embarrassment, a desire to itch, and a mild heat rash. Ianthe was screaming over the comm. Everyone waited politely for her to stop. You said, "Is that all?" And with a crackle, God said,
"It will be like this until they breach Harrowhark."
The princess of Ida's voice came over the communicator, a little ragged.
"How long?" "Over an hour," said Mercy.
And Augustine said,
"Sit tight, kiddies. The fun starts now."
Your room had long ago plunged into near-complete darkness, leaving no distraction from the great rocking thump, thump, thump of body after body flinging itself against the great mass coating the hull. There was nothing to see. The shutters were down. But you could feel the terrible vibration, hear the groan of chitin on metal, the cataclysmic rending of steel by fungus claw. It was very cold. A fine shimmer of frost now coated your cheeks, your hair, your eyelashes. In that smothering dark, your breath emerged as wisps of wet grey smoke. Sometimes you screamed a little, which no longer embarrassed you. You understood your body's reaction to the proximity. Screaming was the least of what might happen. God's voice came very calmly over the comm.
10 minutes until breach.
And you walked to your death like a lover. Epiperidos. 9 months and 29 days before the Emperor's murder.
These two are intended for you, said Harrowhark, Nona Jesimus. They are to be opened only in the event of my death, or of the other happenstance, though I have very little hope of you not opening them the moment my back is turned. The other 22 are written in an unbreakable code only I can decrypt, intertwined with a false chamber code that, if even merely beheld, curses you, your family, and the restive bones of your ancestors for as long as the name of Ianthe Tridentarius is whispered in necromantic hearing. 24 in all.
I would have just gone with a blood ward, personally, said Ianthe.
A blood ward is for those without imagination, said the astonishingly nude-faced girl.
The 9th necromancer, unpainted, was revealed to be a lean-faced, diamond-jawed nunlet with very dark brows divided by a criss-cross frowning mark. Striking-looking, certainly, even spiritual. A good subject for a painting, if you were ready to settle for the 9th house, frowned.
As I cannot reasonably expect not to bleed for the next myriad, I cannot rely upon a blood ward, and neither should you. Are we going to do this, third, or not?
This may not work.
You have reminded me.
I'll say it again. The procedure could fail, or it may work, but only temporarily. There could be any number of side effects. Physical disorders, if you push your brain too hard, any surgery could simply heal over. And if you're doing what I have a suspicion you're doing, it could play merry hell with scar tissue. This is profoundly experimental. More to the point, it is totally fucking demented. Their eyes met in the mirror. The ex-reverend daughter had set one up in front and one above her head, which was being held by two of the obedient skeletons of the sort she so obviously loved. Ianthe still did not understand the entrancing appeal of the dark aptitude of the bone. It was as though somebody had decided to make flesh magic less flexible, less subtle, and much less interesting to look at. What was the joke again? That the 9th house knew 1,000 shades of off-white? She looked down at the tray of tools. Scalpel. Saw. Little bottle of water with a spray nozzle. And astonished herself by saying, 9th. Maybe this is an 11th hour point to make, but I find myself making it. Tell me what you are doing. Tell me the details of your grim, dark, and shadowy plan. If you don't, I have no assurance that I am not about to have a front row seat as you reduce yourself to a gibbering wreck, or lower, a vegetable, a hunk of wood, a 4th house write-in advice column. The nun did not answer. Ianthe made her voice as low and coaxing as it could go, and she pressed, Make me understand what this is worth to you, 9th. Think about what you've promised. Consider what I am, and what use you might get from me. I am a lictor. I am a necromantic princess of Ida. I am the cleverest necromancer of my generation.
Like hell you are, said Harrowhark.
So impress me, said Ianthe, unmoved. In the mirror, that paintless, unfamiliar face tightened. The lips pressed together until they were the pale brown of roses, ashen. Ianthe found herself thinking what the face could have done to it. The top lip was softly curved, as though the painter had not been able to help embellishing where they thought nobody would notice. The arch of that philtrum was close to a poem. The cheek was unreasonably smooth, considering the amount of topological grease paint those ninth house paws must have seen. Those heavy eyelids, deep set, thick with black lashes, a vanity that nobody in that shuffling mausoleum had thought to shear. And that was not even considering that the face was taut and stricken with the starvation marks of agony, that she had shaven her head almost fully bald for this, leaving only pinpricks of black stippling her skull. Then there were the eyes themselves, that solemn and lightless black that, whatever rictus the nun's face might assume, could not hide the woman. They stared out of Nona Jesimus's face now with mute, flayed appeal, as stark and discomforting as skinless muscle.
"I will impress upon you this," the ninth necromancer said forebodingly and stopped. Then she said, "I asked you for a reason. That reason was not your genius, which I admit exists. Nobody who reverse-engineered the literal process could be anything but a genius. But I haven't seen anything that makes me believe you are more than a kind of necromantic gymnast doing showy tricks without concern for the theory. You're not of Sextus's caliber either."
"No," said Ianthe lightly, "but Sextus's head exploded, proving to the world that he hadn't accounted for everything."
"I may have been Sextus's necromantic superior, but he was the better man. You are not even so worthy of that brain as to wipe its bloodied remnants from the wall," said the ninth. "You are a murderer, a conwoman, a cheat, a liar, a slitherer, and you embody the worst flaws of your house, as do I. Nonetheless, I did not ask you because you are a lictor, third. I did not even ask you because you know significantly more about your subject than I do.
Tell me, because I am hugely bored of hearing all my flaws," said Ianthe, with lessened patience.
The shadow cultist stared into the mirror. Those great black eyes were empty pools, abyssal holes, an oil spill in the dark, or unfilled sockets.
"I asked you, because you know what it is," she said haltingly, "to be fractured."
Of such banality was grief made.
"Harrow Hark," said Ianthe, "let me give you a little advice. It is free and smart. I'll walk this back now. I'll adopt the sweetest good humour about everything you've done for me already. If you admit that you are running away, and running away is for fools and children. You are a lictor. You have paid the price. The hardest part is over. Smile to the universe, thank it for its graciousness, and mount your throne. You answer to nobody now.
If you think that you and I are not more beholden than ever," said the girl, "you are an idiot.
Who is left?
What is left?"
Nona Jesimus shut her eyes briefly. When they opened, one was not correct. She stared at her own heterochromatic night-and-day gaze, at those celestially mismatched irises, one black, one gold. Then the ninth house lictor said tightly,
"We are wasting time. Open me up."
"It will be worse for you in the end, Nona Jesimus." And Harrow Hark roared,
"Do it, you faithless coward. You swore me an oath. Expose the brain, guide me, and let me handle it from there. There's still time, and you thieve it from me."
"All right, sister," said Ianthe, and she reached for the awl first. The hammer would be second. The hammer for the living hand, the awl for the dead. She rested it high on the frontal bone, squinted and gauged. "Time to absolutely fuck you up." She struck.
Once Harrow Hark was sleeping, a sleep she might never even wake from, her face marked with the lines of weary, heart-heavy exhaustion, Ianthe sat and watched. She had not been allowed to watch the entire process. For a stretch, she had been forced to sit behind a screen and twiddle her thumbs as those paranoid amateur hands rummaged around in a way that would hopefully mean Harrow Hark couldn't coordinate enough to piss, if life was remotely fair. Now she pressed her fingers over that scalp, trying to work it out, trying to see exactly what had been done. She gave up within a few minutes. Impossible to tell with Lictor privacy, even this close. No bleeds, certainly. Everything in the right place. Maybe a little reduction in the temporal lobe, a few out-of-order bumps in the temporal gyrus that might have been there already. As a last act of pettiness, Ianthe coaxed a new crop of that lightless black hair out of the scalp and fidgeted with the follicles so that they would squirt out a little extra, cursing the ninth house nun to almost ceaseless haircuts. It was the little things that mattered. She stood at the doorway and watched the breath minutely fill those lungs in and out and in. There were smudges of sweat on the face that in this light looked just like tears. It tickled her fancy to imagine Harrow Hark falling asleep, crying, like any lovelorn child. What a fool. What a destructive, romantic, ridiculous act. It was always a certain kind of ass who approached love like that. A certain kind of very good, talented ass who had been overly used to their hands on the reins and never could cope when they were taken off, nor had the personality to put them back on again. Ianthe had that type of personality, and she had a few years on Harrow. "Someday I'll marry that girl," she said aloud. "It might be good for her. And probably not, though." And then Ianthe the First went to see a man about a queen.
Act 5 Chapter 40 A Series of Question Marks. Harrow Nova held her black rapier thrust upward in the direction of the top tier shaft. She laid her offhand arm across her chest, her knuckles against her collarbone, where the black chain of Samael novenary, true black Dreaber steel, each link a death's head, the weighted end a carved butterfly of pelvis in lead-filled bone, clinked unmusically against itself. Her nerves were steel. Her guts were some lesser material, due to a curious admixture of fear and fury. They had assumed the qualities of gruel or hot porridge. "To the floor," she said.
"Harrow," said the cavalier opposite her, "we don't have to do this."
"Then withdraw your claim and acknowledge me as the Cavalier Primary, you weed, you worm, you slime. I'm your superior in every way. I do not possess your size, I do not possess your strength, but I have trained for one singular purpose, and I will not be denied this chance."
"Yes, Harrow, but my father would kill me," he said.
Ortus Nigenad hulked before her sadly. Massive in his new robe and boots, with new panniers, too, and his grandmother's rapier, the new boots and rapier she envied, but the panniers she did not. They were freshly crafted of obsidian, and the strongest type of canvas, which must have emptied out the treasury. Harrow wondered bitterly if her parents had flogged something. Ortus was all muscle and fat. He had the desired enormity of the modern Ninth House Cavalier, and she never could have hoped to match it. She had never tried. Harrow realized early in her career that if she could not have the size, nor the weight, nor the sheer breadth, that she would have the speed, the technique, the agility. She had decided this at around 5 years old. Denied of weapons, it had been Harrow who had climbed the Anastasian monument and retrieved the chain of Samael, the sacred relic of the long-dead warrior servant of the original tomb-keeper. For that sin she had been forced to strip before the very altar she stood before now, as the Reverend Father, whipped stripes into her back, until the daughter had intervened. Now Harrow had the chain, but the daughter never let her forget the intervention.
"Harrow,"
said the skull-faced cavalier of frightful aspect. Upon stepping down from his post 5 years previous, Mortis had scarified the skull into his son when the adopted necromantic heir had confirmed Ortis for her cavalier primary. The cicatricial lines showed clearly beneath the paint.
"They will never let you go. I truly wish they would. I do not long to travel to the first house. I do not dare imagine to serve a lictor, let alone stand against one, as in the days of Nonius."
"Matthias Nonius never stood against a bloody lictor."
"It is clear in the histories.
Half the page was gone."
"A suggestive emendation makes it clear that..."
"I am the daughter of the ninth house," she said, cutting off whatever he had to say about suggestive emendations. "I am the unfulfilled vow and the bloody teeth of the unkissed skull. I acknowledge myself as a cruel disappointment. I may have been supplanted. I may be no real heir to the mysteries that belong only to the reverend line, but I will bear the sword. If I am no adept, it is my right to carry the blade instead."
Ortus Nigenad wiped the sweat off his forehead. The candlelight limned the carved hurts of his face, but his expression did not match their fearsomeness. The panniers of bone at his back rustled pleasantly in the manner of a child's sandpit.
"Harrow," he said, "you do not even really want to carry the blade for her."
"No," she said. "I hope she gets boiled alive in oil. I hope she falls into a hole with a crowd watching. I hope someone takes a large pair of secateurs to the muscles at the backs of her heels. I so genuinely and wildly long to see that. I would buy tickets."
Ortus said tremulously.
"But you know she quite..."
"No."
"And they say she is petitioning for..."
"Continue that sentence," she said, "and I'll make it to the pain."
"Harrow," he said doggedly, "I would become cavalier secondary in the veriest heartbeat. How honourable still to be a cavalier secondary of Dreaba, and to stay at home and look faithfully after the family, and not go out into the unkind arms of space and of foreign houses. But even if I said, 'Yes, I acknowledge Harrow Nova as my better,' your... the reverend mother and father would not accept it. You would have to kill me before they would consider you, and it is the least of my desires to be killed."
"You are right," said Harrow.
His relief was palpable. His shoulders sagged forward, though that was possibly due to the panniers hastening his scoliosis. Iglamine was always scolding him about posture.
"Look at Harrow. She stands like a monument," she would say. "You stand like a damned fishhook."
Ortus leant heavily against the pews with a sigh of relief, and he said,
"Thank you. Good. I am glad."
"And I consider it a salient point," continued Harrow.
She took the sword from her chest and slung her chain from over her shoulder and seized one weighted end between her gloved fingers. The welter of fury inside her resolved into a wet rush, like metal poured into a mould, and, as it always had, the sword became an extension of her arm.
"Prepare to die, Ortus Nigenad. Commit your soul to the locked tomb and to the rock and to the chains, and hope it floats high on the river."
"For God's sake, Harrow, please."
Their voices had carried. The little sacristy door flew open. Marshal Crux emerged, hoary, wearing his most formal, mouldering leathers, his raddled face aghast and his liver-spotted hands trembling with indignation.
"Swords drawn," he cried. "Swords drawn in the narthex, before the altar, and before the vesting tables, and with the icons watching. You besmirch us, you sully us, you debase this place."
"Forgive me, Marshal," said Harrow.
I do not speak to you,
croaked Crux with solemn dignities. Crux was the only reliable source of sympathy in Harrow's life. Sympathy always delivered in such a way as to be horribly unfair to everyone else, but sympathy all the same, and as unpopular as it made her, she would not have swapped it for anyone else's tenderness.
I speak to the Cavalier Primary. Ortus the Ninth, fool that you are, you ought to know better.
Forgive me, Marshal,
said Ortus humbly, as was his wont, as though he had any part in it. Sometimes Harrow hated him for that.
I will not, said Crux indignantly. Go rush to your cuckoo's side. They are nearly done with the arrangements.
The Cavalier Primary stiffened, and with the faintest note of reproach he murmured something. The tone of his murmur did not quite make it too defensive. Ortus, even being well over 30, could not do anything but mumble before the Marshal. Crux barked out a noise that was too old to be a laugh.
What's that? What's that, you egg? I oughtn't to call her such. Choke yourself. Burn yourself. Bury yourself. If you have the bottle to tell that cockerel what I name her, I will think the better of you for it.
True to form, and with no more self-defence than a huge and aggravated sigh, Ortus set off in the direction of the sacristy. As he left, Crux was muttering,
Rueful day when we send Flotsam to be our champion. Rueful day when we send Jetsam to be its sword. Hark.
Only Crux added on hark. It was carefully elided by everyone else. Thought it reminded people she was.
Be gentle with your weapon, and do not make it naked before the altar.
He lumbered closer to her, coughed wetly, and added in a hoarse and patently audible whisper,
There are pilgrims here even now. It would be pretty to apologize.
There were pilgrims. She was embarrassed not to have noticed. They must have come in without her perceiving them. Two visitors kneeled toward the back of the pews, on the kneeling rail, their black church robes taped with brown around the right shoulders to show their house affiliation. She sheathed the rapier in its ragged scabbard and reshouldered the chain she had polished so carefully, and performed a rather half-hearted bob in the direction of the altar as she made her way down the aisle. At her approach, one of the pilgrims shook her hood back. She wore spectacles, and her thick brown hair was neatly bound back in a black fillet, as was customary. The man next to her had shaved his head and kept running a hand over it surreptitiously like a child at its first cropping. Harry was surprised to see the first pilgrim give her a weary, troubled smile, as though the woman knew her. It was a smile that was sorry you had missed the mark in your exams, but thought you had not quite studied hard enough. Harrow had never set eyes upon her in her life. She did not know her. She did not know her husband. Except, how had she known that the man was the woman's husband? This isn't how it happens, said Abigail.
Chapter 41 ?
The music was raucous to Harrow Hark's ears. The stringed instruments, viols, a piano, all played in carefully tasteful modulation, but to her affrighted senses it seemed as though they were blasting full bore directly into her tympanic chambers. It was very warm inside the amphitheatre, and despite the kindness of the candlelight, despite the electric lights being dimmed to an attractive submission, playing out over the assorted massacre of the crowd in its eye-hurting panoply of colour, her eyes still felt like they were bleeding. The Reverend Daughter's veil of office had been pinned back upon her head, precisely where it was no use to her. The crowd, at least, thinned out considerably near their delegation. No matter the bewilderment of the occasion, no matter the crush in the room, Nobody really wanted to get close to the House of the Ninth. Harrowhark was glad for this on two levels. One, because she hated the press of people. Two, because in the dimness and with distance, there was less chance for other guests to notice the shabbiness of their finery. The lacework of her robes had been patched with thread as close to the original black as possible, but not quite matching, as was the perpetual trouble with blacks. The brocade of her skirts was stiff from bad storage. She was not ashamed of the ancient diadem and torque collar she wore. Both had been taken gently from the corpse of an ancestor, before that ancestor had sighed into powder under the beam of the torchlight. But she did not like what their patches of rust signified of their poverty. Harrowhark fretted with the edges of her veil. "It's no use the damn thing being down," said her captain, sotto voce. "I do not intend to compete," said Harrowhark, not moving her lips, but inclining her face very slightly toward the woman next to her. "If I did, I would never compete with my face."
"Yes, but you might as well have one," said the older woman calmly. "That's the first thing Her Divine Highness will look for in a bride, presence of a face. It's a precondition of attraction."
"That is not why we are here. Unlike every other house scion present, I will not flaunt my goods in the shop window."
"Emperor knows what we'd even flaunt,"